I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and the U.S. government has stepped into uncharted territory after last night's takeover of the insurance giant AIG to save it from collapse. Today, White House said it's not ruling out more bailouts after putting up $85 billion to save AIG. Another unprecedented move today, the Treasury Department announced it would auction, starting this afternoon, $40 billion in bonds, the proceeds going for the first time to the Federal Reserve to help the central bank deal with borrowing needs. So, what's going on, and where does it go from here? We're going to spend much of the first half hour of the program trying to answer those questions. We start with Jesse Eisinger, senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio. And Jesse, welcome back. And I'm hoping you can address the latest news from the Treasury Department first. They're going to begin selling these bonds for the Federal Reserve to help the bank raise money, and they say in their release, to deal with more unprecedented borrowing needs ahead. So what does this mean to you?
Thanks for having me back. The Federal Reserve has a balance sheet just like any bank or any person, really, assets and liabilities, and it needs to be shored up from time to time if it's going to have unprecedented lending as it has been. What the Federal Reserve has been doing is lending to not only banks, which is its normal function, but investment banks in the last half year or so in an extraordinary new intervention to help shore up the financial markets. And it's also taking in collateral from these lending institutions, these financial institutions that it hasn't taken before, subprime mortgage collateral, in some cases, stocks, equities. And so what it needs to do is shore up its balance sheet, just like we're seeing all these financial firms having to raise capital. The Federal Reserve is too.
Well, what it does is
from the federal government.
But why would anyone want to buy bonds in the government, given the projected $1 trillion deficit ahead of this week's news?
Well, the United States is still the most stable, most important economy in the world. So we are going to borrow from our citizens and the rest of the world. We borrow a lot of money from foreign central banks right now, from, say, China. And these lenders to us are going to not stop lending, but they're going to be worried about whether they're going to get paid back. And so they're going to pull back on demand. That means that the prices of our treasuries are going to fall. The inverse is that interest rates will rise. As demand falls, the price falls and interest rates go up. And what that means for the federal government is that it has to pay a higher rate of interest on its borrowing.
This is a good deal for China. This is a good deal. They can say, sure, we'll buy your bonds, and we just want them with a really high interest rate.
Our lifestyles have been a great deal for China over the last several decades. What we've been doing is we have been living beyond our means. We've been buying stuff from China. We give them dollars, and they recycle them back into our economy by buying our bonds, by buying Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper as well. And it's a form of vendor financing. They're lending us money so we can buy their products and live beyond our means.
Well, and this is all an attempt to keep the government from being as over-leveraged as apparently many American homeowners and, as we're learning, investment companies are. This is a word that you used with us a year ago, your fear of over-leveraging. Remind us what that is, first of all. With homes, we know there's a couple of examples, but you may have put down very little, and so your ratio of what you've put down to your debt is way too high, you owe too much, or your house isn't worth anymore what your mortgage requires you to pay. And with the companies, it's the same thing. They were over-leveraged.
We're living with the aftermath of a wildly over-leveraged financial system. And I think the easiest way to do it is to think about you buying a home. When you buy a home, you put down 20%. Let's say you're buying a $1 million home. You put down $200,000. You borrow $800,000 from the bank. Mm-hmm. You've got a $1 million home. You're levered 5-1. Million to your equity of $200,000. Lehman Brothers was levered 45-1. Mm. What that means is going back to your house example, if your house drops by 20%, you have no more equity in the house, but you still owe that $800,000 mortgage. Now, let's say you want to go out and fund your lifestyle and you have a credit card and you want to go and make some big purchase of a washer dryer on your credit card, the credit card company is going to say, look at your assets and say, wow, you don't have any more equity. You need to put a little bit more down before we're going to lend money to you. That's what happened to Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers had a $600 billion balance sheet. It was levered, as I say, in some cases, it fluctuated, but 40, 45 to 1. That meant that it had such a thin layer of capital. All it could withstand was a decline of 2 or 3% in those $600 billion of assets, and its capital was going to be wiped out.
Right.
Well, and investors were very worried about this.
Well, and as were you, as we said, a year ago, you wrote an article called Wall Street Requiem, and you said at the time further that investment houses were over-leveraged in complex derivatives. As simply as you can, just remind us what they are.
Sure. One of the things that fueled the housing bubble was that mortgage companies were going out and making mortgages and then selling them to Wall Street. Wall Street was bundling these mortgages up, mostly from subprime borrowers, but also from prime borrowers and borrowers who were not stating their income. We've heard a lot about liar loans and things like that. They were bundling these things up into complex securities, structured financial securities, and slicing them up and selling them to investors around the world, banks, insurance companies, money management companies, hedge funds. And these transactions were in themselves very highly levered. And the investment banks were retaining portions of these on their balance sheet, but putting very little capital against them because mostly what they were doing is selling the risky portions to, say, a hedge fund and retaining the top slice that they thought was never going to be damaged. They were never going to lose money on it. And that turned out to be drastically wrong. From their own credit models were completely wrong, and so they've been losing money on this. And in part, it was fueled by this bundling, which we call securitization on Wall Street, and also credit derivatives, which made these securitizations even more complex because they layered on top of it a derivative component. And a derivative is a complicated notion. Most people struggle with it. But really what it is it's a side bet. You and I bet on a football game, and the outcome of the bet is derived by the outcome of the game. The Dallas Cowboys play the Green Bay Packers, and you and I have a $100 bet. That's like a derivative, and it's not. There's nothing underlying it except for the underlying outcome of the game.
Right,
it's derived by that.
You're going to bet, as to how these things perform. Well, somebody who really seemed to see them ahead of time was Warren Buffett. We want to bring into the conversation, not Warren Buffett, but Michael Lewitt, who's president of the Florida-based money management firm Harsh Capital Management, LLC, was with us yesterday. And Michael, yesterday you told us off air, you reminded us that Warren Buffett called these credit derivatives weapons of mass destruction. He says you don't know what they're going to do until they hit, and that this, what's happening this week, is, sort of those chickens of Warren Buffett predictions coming home to roost. Tell us more about that.
Well, the problem with these derivatives is that they grew up in a market that went completely unregulated. So at this point, no one really knows who owes what to whom. And as a result, one of the great fears with respect to AIG was that no one really knew what the exposures were. They knew really based on hearsay and nothing else and on general market knowledge that AIG had counterparty relationships with virtually every financial institution in the world. But there was no central base of knowledge for what that meant.
I was going to say, in part because the person, the maybe insidious, nefarious person who maybe sold a loan to somebody in Kansas who really couldn't afford it, had long since disappeared, didn't care about collecting on that mortgage, and it had sort of disappeared down the pipeline. But, when you say nobody could see where these, where the money was going and where the, which loans were being paid. But in effect, people were seeing that there were problems. Michael, you've indicated you saw them, and we're hearing from Jesse that he saw them. And here's Jim Cramer of CNBC's Mad Money. I can't get enough of this sound. It was him a year ago, enraged about the lack of response from Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. But most of all, the government just not seeing what was going on. Let's listen.
I have talked to the heads of almost every single one of these firms in the last 72 hours, and he has no idea what it's like out there. None! My people have been in this game for 25 years, and they are losing their jobs, and these firms are going to go out of business, and he's nuts! They're nuts! They know nothing!
Jesse, what happened? What went wrong? I mean, it's a little extreme, but he if you watch him regularly, he's genuinely been, you know, angry for a year now. Why didn't people see what he saw or you saw?
Yes, that was the calming influence that I worked under at TheStreet.com for a couple of years back in the late 90s. The authorities really dropped the ball, and Michael's absolutely right that the credit derivatives market is a major part of this story, and it goes back into the 90s when credit derivatives were explicitly deemed not to deserving of regulation. And that was done by Wendy Graham, Phil Graham's wife, in the early 1990s when she was the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And then it was subsequently ratified by Bill Clinton in the late 1990s, right as he was leaving office. And that's one aspect of the story. And
I want to just jump in and ask, are you referring to the Graham-Leahy Act? This was, you mentioned Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, but this was the act which repealed part of the Glass-Steagall Act that said banks shouldn't be able to invest in other companies. In other words, it was part of the deregulation, and this was Phil Graham.
That was certainly part of the era of financial deregulation that we went through that culminated in the in this credit crisis. But I'm referring to the Commodities Modernization Act of 2000, which deregulated credit derivatives. But there were a series of rulings like this. And then we had the Federal Reserve in the 2004-2006 timeframe shirk its regulatory duties about mortgage lending. So we have a colossal failure of regulation across the governmental spectrum. Not only did these Wall Street executives get themselves into terrible trouble, but we also failed to regulate them.
But Wall
Edward
Street
Gramlich,
also didn't want, excuse me.
Sure.
I mean, Wall Street, you know, was fully complicit in this. You know, there's a wonderful story. It's not so wonderful, I guess. Years ago at a Grant's Interest Rate Observer conference, an executive from Lehman Brothers stood up and said something to the effect that his bosses had no idea or no understanding of the derivative contracts that were being traded by his firm in massive amounts. He went back to the firm and was fired that night.
For telling the truth, that he didn't understand it. That's Michael Lewitt. A terrific story to go into the break on. We're only going to take a minute. Michael, president of the Florida-based money management firm Harsh Capital Management. It's a very telling story, Michael. We'd like you to pick it up on the other side of the break with Jesse Eisinger, senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio. And I'd still like to know, all right, regulators abdicated their responsibility, but what about people who do ratings? Isn't there someone who's supposed to be telling us whether or not these investment houses are functioning the way they're supposed to? We'll take that up after a break. You're listening to Here and Now. We're back with our look at Wall Street, which is looking a little bit tattered today after the U.S. takeover of AIG, the global insurance giant. We've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio, and Michael Lewitt, president of the money management firm Harsh Capital Management, LLC. And Michael, I just want to pick up with you. You were telling us a story about how somebody dared to question how an investment house was functioning, saying he didn't understand these derivatives we've been talking of, and he was fired. The moral of that story seems clear.
Well, the moral of the story is that Wall Street doesn't like to look in the mirror. Nobody complained when these firms were minting money, selling these complex derivatives, largely to customers who didn't understand them. We all remember the story of Orange County and Robert Citron, the treasurer, who bought massive amounts of securities, complex derivatives and securities from Merrill Lynch, and bankrupted the county, and his defense was he didn't understand what he was buying. Well, this has gone on for a long time, And no one complains on Wall Street when you're making money. When you lose money, everybody complains.
Well, but Jesse Eisinger, I just want to ask you, our understanding is that there are people who are watchdogs. There's Moody's and other companies that are supposed to rate these houses and rate the bonds. What happened?
Yes, with Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch are the rating agencies, and they, in the wake of this abdication of responsibility from the regulators, these credit rating agencies became the de facto regulators. And the terrible thing is they're so deeply conflicted because the Wall Street firms pay them for the ratings. So the Wall Street firms are their customers, and they're in charge essentially of watchdogging the Wall Street firms. Of course, it's an untenable position.
Right.
And these guys, through a combination of incompetence and these conflicts of interest, misrated the structured financial paper and the credit derivatives paper that we're talking about. Their models failed dramatically, and I think they looked the other way at any problems that they thought would come up in the mortgage market and the junk loan market. And this is something we're going to have to deal with for maybe years, if not decades. And Michael's absolutely right that Wall Street needs to look in the mirror. The one point that he didn't make, I'm sure he agrees, is that these guys took down hundreds of millions of dollars, Stan O'Neill, Chuck Prince, Dick Fold, while the times were good, and they don't have to give any of that back when.
No, that's right. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, there was an undue dependence on mathematical models, and I think there's a very serious flaw that lies at the heart of what's going on here, and that's that all investing can be reduced to ones and zeros, to digits, to numbers, and that's simply not the case. And this has been proven. I was a comparative literature major and a history major in college, and it didn't take a computer science degree to know that 35 times leverage or 30 times leverage was too much for an investment firm, or that 100 times leverage was too much for a structured investment vehicle. There's something called common sense, and there's something called good judgment. And it went completely on vacation on Wall Street because people were blinded by money.
Okay, quick question for both of you. The San Francisco Chronicle writes, "One thing's for sure, when the smoke clears, the American financial system is going to look very different." Jesse, you first. What do you think it will look like?
Well, we're going to have to overhaul the financial regulation in this country and completely change the way we think about regulating these firms. We're going to make sure that they have adequate capital at the heart of that. And I think we're going to have a long, ugly period in the economy where the financial system has to deal with all of its bad loans and bad investments and can't lend money out properly. We've got a broken financial system, and it's going to be years before this fixes itself. And the problem here is that the assets keep falling. So the house prices keep falling and corporate debt is falling in value. And the Federal Reserve and all the bailouts in the world can't solve that.
Well, another problem, Jesse, is as you said to me earlier this morning, we are in the middle of a presidential campaign. We have a lame duck president. There was a very contentious White House press conference this morning where reporters were trying to get a spokesperson to say, what does the president think about the economy? And she said, her response, Dana Perino's response, was, you're trying to drag me into the campaign. And they were saying, no, we really want a quote from the president. How much is that going to muddy the water?
Well, it's all being done on an ad hoc basis by Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, because there's no policy apparatus in the Bush administration to deal with this. They're totally ill-equipped, and I don't think that they have any view on this, and their responses have been belated. So this is just Hank Paulson making it up as he goes along. Some of it he's getting right, some of it he's getting wrong. We don't know what the real consequences are going to be, and this is going to be a terrible mess for the next president, and I think job number one.
And Michael, just one last question to you before we have to say goodbye for today. Something tells me we're going to be picking this up again. Again, you're with a money management firm. John Spooner, who's the investment advisor with the Spooner Group here, has said clients shouldn't be worried unless it's Armageddon. Are we at financial Armageddon? What would, you know, if you had some advice, what would it be?
Well, my advice is, excuse excuse me, that this better be as close to Armageddon as any of us see in our lifetimes, because if it gets any worse, it will be Armageddon. And I, what I tell people is, right now is a time to be very cautious with their funds. And as you can see from today, with the behavior of gold,
and gold is doing what? Dropping? I haven't seen.
No, gold is rising very.
Oh, so people are switching.
Yeah, I mean, the only stock I own is GLD, which is the ETF for gold. And the reason is because I know what happens in periods like this, and that's that everything goes, you know, everything that has risk associated with it goes down, and things like gold go up.
Well, but I would just caution people to call their broker, too, because you'd hate to see people just pulling everything out left and right. That's Michael Lewitt, president of money management firm Harsh Capital Management. Michael, thanks as always. Jesse Eisinger, senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio. It's a conversation, obviously, that's going to be ongoing. I want to thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Well,
thank you.
And still ahead today, what do these financial problems mean for people in dire need, like returning veterans? We'll speak to one after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
We will never have a repeat of the Walter Reed scandal, and we owe our veterans every health care and every educational benefit that they have earned.
There's no responsibility that I take more seriously, because America's commitment to our servicemen begins at enlistment, and it must never end.
The two presidential candidates speaking recently about veterans. Well, our next guests wonder if promises made to veterans can be kept regardless of who wins the presidential election. Army Sergeant Juan Jimenez was struck by two roadside bombs in Iraq. He came home with two Purple Hearts, shrapnel lodged in his arms, and various ailments. Nearly 4 years later, he's still fighting for disability benefits, and he's part of a so far unsuccessful class action lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs. We want to take a look at the status of veterans' benefits, and we begin with Sergeant Jimenez from his home in Yucaipa, California. Sergeant, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Robin?
I'm just fine, and we want to find out how you are, but first I also want to introduce journalist Joshua Kors. His story about Sergeant Jimenez appears in the new issue of The Nation, and he joins us to continue the conversation we've been having, Joshua, about veterans' benefits. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And Sergeant Jimenez, let's start with you. First of all, tell us, what injuries did you sustain in Iraq? What happened to you? And then what happened when you went to get benefits?
I was given my gunner time to rest, so I got up in a gunner's hatch, and while we was riding down the street to secure a pipeline that was destroyed, I struck an IED, and I had shrapnel to the right arm, and I was evacuated out.
And what happened the second time you were struck?
The second time, we actually were driving through Sadr City, and then we started receiving mortar fire. We hit a couple more IEDs, and I was struck in the face.
This was in 2005. What were the results of these incidents? What were some of the effects you were feeling?
The first one, I was knocked unconscious, and soon after that, I started experiencing headaches. The second one also, I was still having headaches. So then I returned home, and I applied for benefits, was granted benefits for PTSD, but when I put in for a traumatic brain injury and for a seizure disorder, I was denied.
We understand you were having seizures, you were having memory loss, you had persistent ringing in your ears, acid reflux disease. Now, how did that impact you?
Basically, I get stomach aches every single night. I don't know if it was from drinking the water or eating the food there.
So you have trouble eating, and from the IEDs that blew up on you, you had scrap metal in your face. So why were you denied benefits? What did they say?
When I went in for the traumatic brain injury, they actually conducted a couple tests on me, and they determined that I had mild traumatic brain injury. But then when the case went to the rating board, I received a letter back stating that I do have mild traumatic brain injury, but it was due to caffeine addiction and a car accident I had 21 years ago.
Caffeine addiction. Were you drinking a lot of caffeine?
The Red Bulls.
Drinking Red Bulls.
Mm-hmm.
And when you'd had the car accident 21 years earlier, did you think you had a head injury from that accident?
No. It wasn't that bad. I was in the hospital maybe an hour.
And had any sign of a brain injury shown up when you had a medical exam when you enlisted, when you went into the military?
Negative.
So, Josh, we have Sergeant Jimenez being denied benefits after a raider. Explain to us the process, because he, as he mentioned, someone had to rate him. Who is the raider?
Veterans come into the VA after being treated, and they go to a separate process where a rater decides just how disabled they are, everywhere from 0 to 100% disabled. The higher the rating, the higher the disability pay, and if they cross a certain threshold, they can secure VA medical care for the rest of their life. In Jimenez's case, the rater decided he did not have service-related seizures. She said there wasn't enough evidence that he had seizures at all, even though he had a seizure while he was at the VA and the doctor had been prescribing him epilepsy medication. You think that would be proof enough, but for the raider, it wasn't. And Robin, we've spoken before about the different situations that veterans are facing when it comes to benefits. Jimenez's case really just continues along that line, and that's what led to the lawsuit in federal court in San Francisco.
And we should say, Sergeant Jimenez, this rater, R-A-T-E-R, you never spoke to this person. The military keeps them anonymous because they don't want them to be influenced by people like yourself, but you never had a chance to even speak to this person.
Negative, ma'am.
Joshua, tell us a little more about this. How veterans who've been injured and are going in to get claims, how do they approach this process? Because I understand they're bringing in paperwork and Purple Hearts and testimony from friends.
I don't think most Americans even realize that when soldiers return wounded from Iraq, before they can collect benefits for their wounds, they have to prove to the VA their wounds came from Iraq. As Jimenez has explained to me, he thought in his case, with the shrapnel that's still embedded in his skin, it would seem obvious that his wounds did come from his service in Iraq. But as his fight goes on 3 years to get benefits, it seems it's not that simple a proof.
Sergeant, when you discovered all this, when you realized how, I mean, did you know you had to bring Purple Hearts to get your benefits? And what was your thinking as it was revealed to you how hard it was to get benefits?
I keep paperwork on everything because I know everything always deals with a paper trail. That's why I have my own paperwork from the doctors in Iraq. And that's what I took to VA as proof that I was actually injured, is doctor statements. But still, you know, they still going against, you know, every documentation that I'm giving them.
Well, what's your thinking about that?
I think that someone needs to redo the system because, you know, they're turning their backs on a lot of us soldiers. You know, we go out and, you know, we do our job, no questions asked, and they turn their backs on us when we get home, and I think that's wrong.
Well, Sergeant Jimenez is part of a class action lawsuit filed by veterans groups against the Department of Veterans Affairs. The suit claims the VA is illegally denying or delaying claims for disability pay and mental health treatment. Now, the vets lost the suit. They're appealing. Joshua, you were there for the trial in April in San Francisco. Now, we remember some of the reporting about the culture in the VA that sort of underlies this story. Remind us of that. What was the VA's defense against these claims?
What made it so extraordinary is that for the first time, top officials from the VA went up on the stand under oath and began to discuss that culture. The testimony that really shocked those in the audience was Michael Walkoff, a deputy undersecretary, and he was hammered by the plaintiffs about a key VA statistic that it takes on average 6 months for the VA to handle a claim. But as Walkoff's testimony revealed, those are truly twisted figures. It really takes 6 months for that first step in the process. If a veteran appeals his case, as 32,000 veterans did last year, it takes an additional 3.5 years for their appeal to be handled. When it comes to VA statistics, if a veteran dies before his case is complete, that's considered a complete case. If a soldier kills himself, that resolves the issue.
Well, for the VA, anyway. And you write that it also adjusts their overall stats because the VA can then average those deaths in and get credit for cases they've closed. We're talking to journalist Joshua Kors and Sergeant Juan Jimenez about veterans' benefits. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this trial and this story is playing out against a backdrop of news stories that we've spoken of on this program. And just to remind ourselves, a high-ranking VA official sent out an email about the high number of suicides among veterans, saying, should we address this or do some sort of release before someone stumbles on it? Daniel Zwerling of NPR reported about the colonel at the Evans Army Hospital who had a memo on his bulletin board warning doctors at Fort Carson not to take soldiers' descriptions of their ailments at face value. So there seemed to be a culture of not believing troops when they came back and spoke of disabilities.
And as the trial revealed, that culture is really grounded in the VA's regulations. Up on the screen, they put a page from the VA's manual for everyone in the courtroom to see. And in that manual, it advises VA doctors not to take veterans' descriptions of their ailments seriously, especially when it comes to PTSD. As the manual said, PTSD is relatively easy to fake.
Well, let's go back to the class action suit that Sergeant Jimenez, you were a part of. As we said, yeah. The judge ruled against you, but only because he said he didn't have the jurisdiction to call for a complete overhaul of the VA, which is what the lawsuit calls for. So what happens to you right now? Can you work? What are you doing? What's your life like?
My life has been a wreck. I have a lot of sleep problems, always guarded and watching my back, and a lot of anger issues as far as when I'm at work. And it makes me not want to be there. Like, I'm missing Iraq. And I was told from my counselor at the VA that's basically PTSD working.
And it's been, what, 3 years?
3 years.
Yeah, since the onset of these. Joshua Kors, what do you think is going to happen now?
Well, I think the hope really is going to come from Congress. The VA committee on Capitol Hill is very aware that when veterans leave Iraq, they face a waiting list 650,000 veterans long. Representative John Hall, a Democrat from New York, has put forward a bill which would try to speed along the system, giving veterans with obvious wounds immediate access to care and benefits. Right now, every veteran, regardless of how obvious their wounds seem, have to go through the proof process of making sure their claim is not a fraudulent one. Jimenez, when it comes to medical care, really shows the split in the system. The VA doctors are not hesitant in the slightest to prescribe medications, but the VA benefit system is quite hesitant to write them a check.
Is there another disconnect here? Why isn't there a chain of reports that starts on the ground in Iraq where the military doctors say, Sergeant Jimenez, jump in.
There is. When we return back, you go to the VA, you not only have your Purple Heart, you have your actual Purple Heart, you have the documentation showing your Purple Heart, you have the documentation showing how you received the Purple Heart, and then you have your line of duty documentation.
Where this becomes an absurdity, when the paperwork showing the wounds that were produced right there at the medical facilities in Iraq isn't enough to make the case, the VA often pushes the veterans to gather witnesses for their wounds, buddy statements they're called. Of course, if other folks who were there in Iraq were killed by the roadside bomb, now the veteran has no witnesses.
Well, we've been speaking with Sergeant Juan Jimenez, Iraq War veteran who also received two Purple Hearts, but is still fighting for benefits he feels he deserves. From the Department of Veterans Affairs, journalist Joshua Kors, his story about Sergeant Jimenez and the recent lawsuit Sergeant Jimenez and other veterans filed appears in the new issue of The Nation. Gentlemen, I hope we have you back to give us an update. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to have an ode to Fellini's 8½, including a listen to the beautiful music from Nino Rota. That's tomorrow on Here and Now. And we'll be back in a minute, Here and Now. The new fall television season is launching, and the big question is, what happened to Susan's husband Mike on Desperate Housewives? And did that show really fast forward 5 years in the season finale? Actually, the bigger question is, how is television faring as people move to their computers for entertainment? And after last season's writer's strike, which cost Hollywood about $1 billion and forced networks to shorten last year's TV season, Bob Thompson is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. He joins us from the school's radio station WAER in Syracuse. Bob, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, we know the networks have cut in half the number of new shows they're premiering.
Oh, yeah.
Is this part of the impact of the strike?
Well, I mean, I think sometimes we overestimate the impact of the strike. The big difference was, of course, that the development season was cut short. But that was a trend that was actually happening anyway. It's so expensive to make all of these pilots, of which only a few are going to go to series, that the strike was almost an excuse for the industry to institutionalize a pulled-back development procedure.
Well, let's talk about those pilots, because we know the networks have cut way back on the number of proposed shows that then get made, but many times don't even get to air. This year, some shows are going directly from scripts to debuting, but that whole pilot system, who can afford to make television shows that don't air?
They can't, and that's why they've quit doing it, and the strike was the excuse to really institutionalize it. We used to get a certain percentage of hits out of the pilots that were made that was maybe, I don't know, 10%. So if you threw 50 shows at the wall, maybe you got 5 good programs. If now a network only makes 5 pilots a year, the yield is necessarily going to go down as well. So we're going to have to see how this new system works.
Okay, well, we want to take a look at some of the new shows. A lot of hype over the CW's new take on the 90s hit 90210, the Beverly Hills Zip Code / teen soap opera. In the new version, the fish out of water are Annie and Dixon Wilson, who've just moved to Beverly Hills from Kansas. The school's resident mean girl, Anna Lynn, decides to befriend the new arrivals. Let's listen.
So listen, Ethan told me how cool you are, and now you're practically like family. So I decided I want to invite you to my birthday party. What do you say?
Oh, my God. I'd love to.
Of course you would. But you're going to need new clothes, so we'll go shopping after school.
Oh, Bob, the show brings back old favorites Jenny Garth and Shannon Doherty in their old roles but grown up. The verdict?
Not good. I mean, the buzz among my students, which is actually a pretty important demographic for the CW, is almost universally negative. The good news was they had actually heard about this show and made a point to watch it. And one of the reasons was 90210 is really underestimated. That was a very important show. There would have been no Dawson's Creek, no My So-Called Life, no Party of Five, probably not even a Buffy the Vampire Slayer had 90210 not plowed that real estate ahead of them.
Well, it sounds like it may not be around for long, so catch it while you can. We also have sci-fi and fantasy-based shows. NBC's new show, My Own Worst Enemy, stars Christian Slater. He plays a guy who is a spy and a family man. It's a split personality. One side of his life doesn't know about the other side of his life. Here's a little bit of the trailer.
I know what you're thinking, Doc, but I did not make this up.
Every guy dreams.
Last night, I was in Paris.
Of living like a secret agent.
It was different from the others.
But for Henry Spivey.
You ever bring home a souvenir from a dream, Doc?
I stick with you, Henry.
It's not a dream.
Edward and I can't meet.
Do exactly as I said. Your life depends on it.
But we can communicate.
Christian Slater. Christian Slater. My Own Worst Enemy. Premieres Monday, October 13th on NBC.
Two Christian Slaters in one. Bob, kind of a tried and true formula, you know, sci-fi, fantasy.
You know, it's extraordinary. Sci-fi did not do well in network television, really up until the age of cable. Even Star Trek, which we think of as the great sci-fi show of all time, was only a modest hit at best back in the 60s when it played. And it, of course, was canceled after 3 seasons. And now this science fiction, the paranormal, is all over the schedule. We've got a cop who wakes up in the 70s after getting hit by a car, this Christian Slater thing. And this, of course, joins things like Heroes and Chuck and all of these other shows. And I think if you want to look at why this big explosion now, I think actually the answer probably comes in one word, which is lost. You know, it's not a genre that's been completely done to death. It's in a context that allows you to do something a little bit different that hasn't been been done in 50,000 other episodes.
Well, speaking of genres, one of the shows that everyone is talking about has to do with vampires. This is the show True Blood. It's from Alan Ball, creator of 6 Feet Under. It's a vampire series on HBO starring Anna Paquin. And I'm wondering, you know, if it has anything to do with there sort of being an interest right now in that whole genre for young people. There's the Twilight books, which are so popular, sort of a vegetarian vampire thing. And in this new TV show, True Blood, it takes place 2 years after vampires have come out of the coffin, quote unquote, to live in mainstream society. They survive on a newly created synthetic blood. And Anna Paquin plays a waitress in Louisiana who can read minds. She meets the vampire Bill.
Hi, what can I get for you tonight?
Do you have any of that synthetic bottled blood?
No, I'm so sorry. Sam got some a year ago, but nobody ever ordered it, so it went bad. You're our first.
The trouble with synthetic bottled blood is it goes bad.
You know,
I've always said that.
It's a problem.
This, I have to admit, happens to be my favorite of all the new shows I've yet seen this season. It's one of those things you've got to watch a couple of episodes and I think get into its rules and its universe, and then before you know it, you're suddenly gripped by it.
Well, and it's graphic, too.
It's not TV, it's HBO.
Right. There you go. Well, another trend this TV season, what Variety calls instant replay, some of the shows that actually started last year and were interrupted by the writer's strike are coming back as if they're brand new shows. One of them, your favorite show, Pushing Daisies. Now let's just listen. The show open explains what it's all about.
This is Ned, a man with the ability to bring things back to life. It was a gift that came with a caveat or two. First touch, life. Second touch, dead forever. And young Ned learned that there was yet another caveat. If he kept a thing alive for more than 1 minute, something else had to die.
Ooh, that's pressure. Why do you like it so much?
It is a beautifully shot show. Color is extraordinary. It's really a very, very different kind of program. Problem with this poor show, and this is one of the shows that I think the strike could really become problematic for, getting a lot of critical acclaim. Everybody who tried it out seemed to really like it. It was building up buzz. And then, of course, they had no episodes in the can. The strike came and it disappeared. I'm a little worried that they touched this thing for the first time and it was about to be a hit. And now we're going to touch it again in the fall and it's going to die.
Well, speaking of resurrecting the dead, which you just did, we just have to mention ER. In its 15th and final season, the show bringing back a couple of favorite characters. Noah Wiley is coming back. Dr. Mark Green, played by Anthony Edwards, is coming back after dying on the show in 2002. Neat trick, but apparently they're doing it in flashbacks.
Right. I mean, I suppose that what ER is going to do, bringing back Mark Green, all this other kind of stuff, is to kind of wrap up, have this kind of sentimental send-off of a show that's been on for a long, long time. This was back in the original of must-see TV. This used to be what you watched after Seinfeld and Mad About You.
And it's the subject of one of the funniest Saturday Night Live skits still ever, when they were all lined up along a gurney, pushing it down the hall through doors, saying, coming through, and they went for about a mile through doors of bringing the gurney through.
It was a great show, but compared to things like Grey's Anatomy, it's looking really long in the tooth. It's ready to go.
Bob Thompson, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.